You're listening to the Hayek Program Podcast. This podcast includes audio from lectures, interviews, and discussions from scholars and visitors of the F.A. Hayek Program for Advanced Study in Philosophy, Politics, and Economics at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. To learn more about the Hayek Program, visit hayek.mercatus.org. To learn about graduate student fellowship opportunities with the Mercatus Center at George Mason University, for students at Mason as well as at universities across the globe, please visit students.mercatus.org.
Hello, we're here today on October 30th, 2025, and I have the great privilege to have a conversation with Angus Bergen, Simon Holliday, and Glory Liu. I want to talk to them about initiatives that they're engaged in intellectual history, reorientation in contemporary thinking, and also pedagogy in the social sciences and the humanities. First of all, thank you for coming on. If you could tell us a little bit about the founding of the Center for Economy and Society at Johns Hopkins and the establishment of this new major in moral and political economy.
Yes, sir, Peter. This is Angus Bergen talking, and I'm happy to speak a little bit about that. So we got a grant from the Hewlett Foundation, which was part of their Beyond Neoliberalism initiative now a number of years ago. And there were a couple of distinctive aspects of that, but one that I was very closely involved in was the creation of this new undergraduate major, which we call Moral and Political Economy. Hopkins, among peer universities, has never had this kind of cross-disciplinary social sciences major that integrates economics with other fields for a variety of reasons I'd love to talk about. We thought that that was an urgent need. And it also gave us the opportunity to bring in a number of new faculties who work in different disciplines, but whose work all in really interesting ways speaks to one another. So we could establish a broader conversation that helps to move all of us out of what sometimes become our disciplinary silos to talk about problems where, for various reasons, we thought cross-disciplinary perspective was needed. And there also is a goal of creating a sort of trans-ideological space, right? In that sense, a space where that was genuinely felt open for people to express all different kinds of ideas. And I don't mean that in some sort of coded language like it's a right-leaning space or a left-leaning space or a radical space, but rather there's a tendency along with disciplinary silos sometimes create methodological silos where certain kinds of methodological questions aren't allowed to enter into the conversation, and that creates difficulties. And similarly, they can create political silos where certain ideas are just a kind of received wisdom and it's seen as strategically unwise for scholars to step outside of those boundaries. And so our goal was to create a space that is genuinely open in all of those ways.
So can I ask an impolite question, which is, do you have buy-in from the Johns Hopkins Economics Department?
It might be best for Simon to speak to that a little bit, since he is himself an economist and has the among all of us has the best sense of the internal dynamics of the economics profession. I will say just at the outset, though, that I was really struck by, I've always felt, as a historian who writes about the history of economics, warmly welcomed by the economics department here. The right when I showed up, they invited me to come in and give a talk and engage very generously with my work. A number of economists here have expressed a lot of interest and enthusiasm in the idea that it's beneficial for economists to be reading and work in and incorporating ideas from other disciplines. One that this is true of many colleagues, I'll especially call out Ali Khan as somebody who from the beginning, from my arrival here, has talked a lot about that. And you can see, I think, that mentality reflected in his own work. And so my own experience, although this might be naive, but has been one of feeling very much welcomed and accepted by the economics department here. I mean, I also will say historically, I think this has been remediated a little bit in recent years, but our economics department has been understaffed relative to the student interests. And so I think they also just welcomed other environments where students who are interested in economics will have the ability to study that at Johns Hopkins without still further overstressing the resources we have available to them. Those are just some initial thoughts. I don't know if Simon would like to add anything.
Simon, you're involved in this core project, which is one about reorienting the way we even teach economics. So yeah.
Yeah. So so a couple of things. Let me just comment first on the economics department at Johns Hopkins and also how we're seeing that relationship evolve. So I'd say there are a few ingredients there. The first is that as an economist, I'm teaching classes in our moral and political economy major that actually count as electives for the economics major. So for example, I'm teaching a course called People, Power, and Pay, the Economics of the Workplace. That is a research lab in moral and political economy. And the crucial thing there is that students are reading a lot of economics papers. They're also using chapters of my textbook. And then alongside that, they're reading some sociologists, some psychologists, some management literature on the idea of the economics of the workplace. And they also have to produce a research paper at the end of the semester. And so I think that the folks in the economics department see our offering in this regard as complementary to, rather than simply a substitute for, what they are offering in their department. And I think maybe we're also alleviating some of the stresses on their department where students can take some of our courses too. I think we also are a complement to them in the fact that all the students in our major are going to be doing an honors thesis. And so that's a requirement of our major. And so I think that some of those students who are going to be double majoring in economics and moral and political economy, they're going to be able to do a thesis with close supervision from someone like myself with disciplinary knowledge, and also potentially get some additional insights from someone in the economics department who isn't necessarily their advisor, but they're really interested in that undergraduate research experience. Now, with respect to Core Econ, yeah, so I'm involved there. I can talk about this more later on the call, but one of the things that I'm involved in there is a new project called Understanding Our Economy, where we're writing a new first-year textbook. For a variety of reasons, the current core textbooks, like the Economy 2.0 Microeconomics and the Economy 2.0 Macroeconomics, they're not as well suited to the North American market. They're very well suited to the British and European markets because of the structure of high school and college there, right? So a quick example of this, like when I was teaching introductory economics at the University of Bristol, which is where I was before I came to Johns Hopkins, we teach our first year classes with calculus, right? And that's just not something that is common in the United States. And so that's not saying that someone has to use calculus when they teach with core, but kind of the idea of, say, indifference curves and the idea of the modulator rate of substitution, those are pretty crucial ideas in the core econ approach of those books. Whereas we're taking some of the same ingredients, but applying them in a different way in understanding our economy.
I've been following the core thing, you know, since the beginning. I'm quite, you know, impressed with the effort to try to change the conversation within the economics profession. I was just wondering about the interaction effect, because in a lot of the PPE programs that have been established across the United States, it's the economics department that's lagging behind a lot of the other ones, just because they don't have the kind of, especially at the more elite programs, because they don't have the kind of people in those things that can have those conversations. But nevertheless, I wanted to ask Gloria a question, because in one of the common themes, especially with Angus and everything, is intellectual history. Angus is a great intellectual historian, but he's also been an editor in that area. You yourself are, you know, this emerging superstar in intellectual history. And you have the 250th anniversary coming up of your main subject area being, and I was wondering if you were, you know, was there any initiatives that were, you know, being introduced because of the 250th anniversary of the Wealth of Nations that we should be, you know, very highly anticipating?
I'm flattered, first of all, that you think I'm an intellectual historian. I like to say that I've been masquerading as one, because I've never sat easily in my own home discipline of political theory and political science. So I appreciate that. To answer your question briefly, yes, there are countless invitations to different things happening all over the world. I've already received invitations for something in Princeton, something in New York with Mario Rizzo's group, and last but not least, in Glasgow to celebrate the 250th anniversary of the publication of The Wealth of Nations, which happily in the United States also coincides with the 250th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. So there's a lot happening around the world. There isn't anything specific that we have planned at Hopkins. And I think that's good, because frankly, I personally am saturated. But I do think it gives everybody, right, listeners, scholars, graduate students, a moment to reflect on the role that Smith has played in whatever grand narratives we tell about American capitalism, capitalism more generally, and also the meaning of political economy. So the way that I have actually capitalized on the opportunities that have arisen because of the 250th is to publish a piece in Hope on the idea of state capacity and the wealth of nations and the meaning of political economy, right? Like everybody thinks that they're doing political economy. Everybody says that they're doing political economy. We need a new moral political economy. We need a different political economy, right? It's a kind of, it's a catch-all term, but it's a very protean term. And so I took the opportunity to write a piece that was really about, to be totally honest, I was asked to write a piece called Smith's Political Economy. And I could either summarize the entirety of Wealth of Nations with the other text, or I could make a claim about what I take Smith's political economy to really be. And, you know, to be shamelessly presentist about it in some ways, but also true to Smith's text, I kind of stuck out a position that's close to Warren Samuels' piece on, he calls it Adam Smith and the economy is a system of power. Right? That if economics is the science of how we meet our needs, political economy is about the norms and laws and institutions and morals that structure the way in which people meet their needs. And Smith's political economy and his ideas across his text really illuminate that. So that's a pitch for my piece, but also a pitch for thinking about Smith in refreshing new ways as we come up on this big anniversary.
So your former colleague, Barry Weingast, has a whole book manuscript on Smith as a political economist.
Oh, yeah. I've had to read it.
He's been working on it for years.
Yep.
Okay. I want to, if I can, go back to one of the issues that Angus just brought up, which is about transcending these different silos, because it is nevertheless the case that the terminology, moral political economy, has certain methodological, analytical, and ideological commitments. This is true for the group at Center for Advanced Study in the Behavioral Sciences with Margaret Levy and the monograph that she and Federica Caraghetti wrote. It's true for in the field of economic sociology, having to do with Karl Polanyi. There's a, you know, it's some of these things are ways to transcend these stilogues, but other than it's like mixing oil and water in some sense, right? So if you read Doug North's response to Karl Polanyi is a great transformation, there's going to be, you know, there's like oil and water at some level. So I was wondering how you negotiate that in your effort to try to promote a conversation that doesn't force you into any category that is predisposed in people's heads, let's say.
Yeah, Peter, that's a great question and a complicated one to answer. I'll take an initial stab at it and then others might want to say something too. So a number of us were involved when we initially created this program in the program at CASPIS at Stanford. So that was certainly on our mind. I know, as I think you were alluding to in your comment, Margaret Levy there talked about being inspired in part by Tim Rogan's book on the moral economist, which takes us full circle back to Polanyi. And so there is this kind of intellectual underpinning. We were implicitly, I guess, referencing that center and that program in establishing the major, but that was not our primary goal. The first thing I want to say is that there's just no perfect term for describing the kind of program that we were trying to create. So let me just begin by outlining a few of the valences that we were trying to avoid. We decided not to call it politics and philosophy and economics or variations thereof, which is what many programs call themselves for a couple of reasons. One is that is itself in its very title implying that you're sort of melding together these separate worlds, right? You have these different disciplines, you're taking three disciplines all at once, right? And a lot of PPE programs are pedagogically structured, not all of them, but many of them, is it can become a little bit of a grab bag of courses across different fields that are difficult to tie together holistically. And so one of our goals was to say, okay, we're going to do something a little bit different, something that some programs have done, and I can talk about some of the models that we have in mind. But that's really focused on saying, no, this is not just an excuse for students who don't want to focus on one discipline to take a bunch of different courses. We really, if you're going to be doing something cross-disciplinary, it's not an inherent good in its own right. It only becomes a good when students are forced to think across the different realms that they're taking courses in, right? To have it add up to something greater than the sum of its parts. And so either this is part of why we're requiring a senior thesis. It's part of why we require a year-long mandatory introductory course. It's part of why we have other pedagogical infrastructures within the major, reading seminars that are supposed to be cross-disciplinary in certain problem areas, ideally related to what students are going to write a thesis on, and so forth, right? We want them to be forcing them at every stage, sophomore year, junior year, senior year, to be thinking across courses, thinking about how does the philosophy course they're taking impact what they're thinking about in economics? How does the history course relate to sociology? Whatever, in relation to specific subject areas that they have declared are their primary concerns, right? So that's step one. We didn't want to be a sort of grab bag PPE program or to follow that model. Secondarily, the phrase moral itself, yes, it can have political valences, although that's less what we had in mind. I think it also has methodological valences. I mean, PPE programs implicitly, and again, in curricular terms, they don't always do this, but they're excluding a variety of humanities disciplines beyond philosophy, right, from their declared remit. And we thought, we really want students to be taking history courses, courses in English literature even, and we have a variety of sample curricula that show how you can pull those in to be further expanding the way that they're thinking about economic thought. There's tons of interesting work that thinks across the realm of literature and economics, and that's part of what we want the students to be doing too. And so for us, the phrase moral was less about signifying any particular political lineage and more saying that if you want to do political economy, we really do think engaging with these deep underlying moral problems, often most deeply discussed in the humanities, is an essential element of that. So that was what we were trying to do, but in all recognition that, and then, you know, the other thing I would add is that political economy has other connotations, which we can talk about, but, and is itself a kind of subfield of political science. And so it's just the inconvenience that any, as is true with all terminologies, any terminology you choose to signify something carries certain valences that you might want it to carry and other valences that you don't. It's choosing. But in doing something a little different than what other people were doing, we were hoping to signify the problems that we were trying to solve.
So I came to Johns Hopkins having taught at Harvard in social studies for 3 years, and I was also a graduate of Berkeley's political economy program. Although when I was an undergrad, it was called the Political Economy of Industrial Societies, which was a mouthful. And they changed it to political economy the year I graduated. I did my postdoc at Brown, which now has a Center for Philosophy, Politics, and Economics. And a lot of the way in which we structured MPE at Hopkins, you can see elements of these different programs. But we also did something very, very tailored for the unique institution that is Johns Hopkins. And also because we think that the intellectual remit of moral and political economy is something very, quite analytically, it's scoped in an analytically particular way. So social studies at Harvard has the required senior honors thesis. It has a required year-long social theory course, but the remit is much broader, right? It's all of social theory from, you know, when I taught it, Thomas Hobbes to post-colonialism. When I was at Berkeley, the introductory theory courses that are mandatory, called Political Economy 100 and 101, there's a lot of variance. Some are taught very much like a standard history of political economy course. Some are more like a history of political thought course with a little bit of economics mixed in there. Because I had the great fortune of getting to build this from the ground up with Angus, we decided that we were going to call our course Social Theories of the Economy, which meant that the economy was really the structuring analytic, right? Get students to think about what this thing that we call the economy is, but not simply from the perspective of one discipline, right? So we wanted to expand that a little bit and think about this in terms of, like, how do we think about the economy as a product of social theorizing and society itself? And that meant we could do a lot of really cool things with the syllabus, which I'm happy Angus and I can talk about that later. The other thing that I'll say about the major that makes MPE, I think, quite different from some of these other really big legacy programs and also PPE programs of the kind of distributional kind, is that the way that students find their part of the program that is the choose your own adventure kind, right? Where you take electives structured by a topic or a theme, is we have pre-designated focus tracks, right? So this kind of encourages students to think across disciplines, but in a much more intentional way, right? So rather than just saying, take 3 courses in philosophy, take 3 courses in politics, take 3 courses in economics, you have to take courses across different disciplines, but structured by a certain problem, whether it's technology and innovation, land and the environment, right, race and inequality. We have 10 focus tracks that students can choose from. So this I think really forces students to think really deeply, but in a structured way. And that's different from, you know, again, how Harvard does this, which is there are fewer thematic requirements because students design their own focus track, right? We have preset focus tracks, although we do give students to design their own. And I think to date, we haven't had any students do that yet. Simon can correct me on that. And, you know, at Berkeley, there are some prefabricated focus tracks, but you don't get as much of that disciplinary diversity or as much of a focus in terms of like a set of problems and questions.
I'll just jump in there, Gloria, just to hit that. Another program that we had, which I think raises some interesting questions that we had in mind as a implicit model, is Law, Letters, and Society at Chicago. Also, like social studies, it's very heavily scaffolded. It's just using law as a kind of analytical center to draw material from different disciplines together. That, you know, we had noticed social studies is now one of the most popular majors at Harvard. Law, Letters, and Society is, you know, I think has twice as many students want to take it as are even allowed to do so at Chicago. So there seemed to be this deep underlying student demand, and we can talk about what drives that. But that's pushing students to try to engage in these kinds of majors, despite the fact, you know, when you look at Law, Letters, and Society, that the longstanding notion that law is, you know, an easy pathway for graduates of these universities has itself begun to erode. And so even as the pathway to the legal academy, which I think has been a standard outcome for PPE programs and others for a long time, has eroded, student demand has only increased.
So I just want to jump in real quick. I find all of that very fascinating. I'll explain why in a second. I'm very envious of what you've been able to achieve. I think Glory might know this, but in our PhD program here in economics, we have a specialty in economic sociology. Viviana Zelizer has confirmed with me that we're the only PhD program in economics in the United States that students can specialize in economic sociology. And it's also the case that I taught for many years a course on teaching economics through literature. And I learned how to do that when I was at NYU, that a research assistant at the time was a woman named Catherine Labio, who then went and taught at Yale and then at Reed. And she was a literature PhD student, but she did her research assistantship in the economics department because she was doing on the literary forms of economic arguments. And so she was showing all these things. And so I thought, oh my God, this is like the coolest thing in the world. And so I taught a course like that for years. So I'm very fascinated by what you're trying to do. And I see it as very related to what Simon and the others that were involved in the core project were trying to do about economics in general. So I'm very enthusiastic about that. But I will tell you, like, one of my frustrations is that we have a minor here in PPE, not a major, undergraduate I'm talking about. And I was one of the principals in founding that with Eric Angier, who was a philosopher here at the time. He's moved back to Sweden since that time. But the way it evolved, the university support, but then also faculty support, it ended up by just being a smorgasbord of classes. So, you know, you had this PPE, and then it's like, how many classes in political science do I take? How many classes in philosophy do I take? How many in economics? And then there was like one final capstone course. And of course, it was probably on Rawls, basically. You know, that's, you know, and then it said, oh, okay, now we had PPE. Which is, you know, that is the opposite of what you guys are doing. And so, but I also see that there's a lot of other programs. I think if you listen to like Ryan Muldoon talk about what they're trying to do at Buffalo or, you know, down in at Tulane and the Murphy, you know, Center, it's not this smorgasbord thing. It's much more along the lines of what you guys are trying to do. And so I guess one of the questions that I have is, and this really is directed at Simon, but the rest of you jump in, which is that, is there kind of like, is this like a critical moment? Like it's like literally like we have met a point where we're at a critical moment scientifically and pedagogically for our discipline, so that there's a groundswell of scholarly and student interest that is driving this new way of thinking about economics versus the pure technical aspect of economics in some sense.
Pete, I love that question. And so I think, like you are kind of alluding to, with my connection to the core program, and then also, so Sam Bowles and I wrote an intermediate microeconomics textbook called Competition, Conflict, and Coordination. And our ideas there are really strongly informed by how we see economics kind of having changed substantially over the past kind of 3 or 4 decades. But to some extent, the undergraduate curriculum hasn't caught up. And just a few things that I want to mention there is that we are thinking about some of the return to what I see as more political economy in the economics discipline itself, So if I even think about the recent Nobel Prize awarded to Joel Mokyr, among others, or the prize to Lynn Ostrom, or obviously the prize to Acemoglu and Robinson and so on. So there's a thread among the work of these people, which is more about kind of political economy and power and institutions than students are often taught in the undergraduate economics major, right? And so given what you were saying about this kind of groundswell or critical moment, Gloria and I are working on a project related to exactly this, where we're trying to get a sense of the lay of the land right now in political economy and PPE type or PPE similar programs across the United States, because there does seem to be this growing groundswell of interest. We also think that this is related to a kind of allied movement in a variety of states towards programs in civic thought or civic leadership in economics. They're similar but different, right? But they also overlap. So if one thinks about the Hamilton School at the University of Florida, right, they have, and they've got, it's a new school, it didn't exist before, and they have two programs. They have a PPEL program, so philosophy, politics, economics, and law, but then they also have a great books program as part of as a separate undergraduate major. And there seems to be student interest in this. And obviously, there are other programs at Arizona State, at the University of North Carolina, University of Tennessee. There's so many different programs that are really growing, where there is this groundswell of interest, both from faculty themselves, but also apparently from students. And so the project that Gloria and I are working on is one where we're trying to get a sense of where all these programs are cropping up, how many students are graduating from them, what do they look like, because there is a huge variety across them. So if you talk about the program that you were just talking about, the minor that you have at GMU, what you talk about is quite representative of a certain subset of programs that we've encountered, where it's like, take some of these philosophies, take some of these politics, take some of these economics courses, and then if you're lucky, there's a capstone, right? Some of them are much more structured. So like our own, where we have this year-long gateway program, and where that kind of facilitates student thinking. Now, what I love about our program and some of these others that exist out there is students create these lovely links, and they can see the like wider trajectory. Now, what I mean by that is I was teaching in my class on Monday stuff about conspicuous consumption, right? And I was showing students how to think about this in a kind of time allocation constrained maximization problem that Sam and I have in our book. But I had two students who had taken our social theories of the economy class, where they had read extracts from Torsten Veblen. And they're like, wow, okay, I am seeing this stuff that I read from Veblen, like published 120 something years ago. But now I'm seeing exactly how it relates to microeconomic theory. I'm seeing how these threads can be drawn together and how I can think about these problems in related ways in the social sciences and humanities. I'm not sure if I've fully answered your question there, but those are the kinds of seeds of thought that I see being peppered around the conversation. And I should also mention that I was also on a seminar yesterday with the Alliance for Civics in the Academy. So that's, I think, another project that exists now coming out of Stanford and led by Josh Ober, among others. So him, Jenna Story, Phil Levine, among others, where there's a strong interest in a kind of centering texts and using texts as a means by which to get students into the conversation, right? And I think that we're also trying to do that in our MPE program. I think other PPE type programs are trying to do that too.
Angus, you mentioned about like where the students go after they graduate with the program. Is it still like is it like over in Oxford or whatever, where they go into law or they go into politics or whatever? I mean, or where are you finding them, you know, directing their postgraduate careers toward?
Well, Pete, our first class is our seniors this year, so we're going to find that out. It's one of the really interesting questions. I mean, I do think that when I ask myself why is it at these, you know, fairly elite R1 universities that there seems to be substantial student demand for these majors, I can't help but think that there is this sort of pre-professional impetus, whether rightly or wrongly, that's drawing them into these kinds of programs. I think it's probably tied in with what's been a catastrophic decline in humanities enrollments over the last 20 to 30 years. It's been true for history departments have seen continuous declines in enrollment for more than 15 years now. I think it was started even earlier in English literature departments and so on. You know, there are lots of debates as to what's causing that, whether there are, you know, whether it's something about the nature of scholarship in that field is driving students away. And that's debatable. But I think that certainly it's student perceptions that they need to have an education that looks legible in some pre-professional way to whatever career they're intending to go on to. Now, we make arguments, and I think they're right, in my own history department, that history is much more legible to potential employers than they sometimes assume. But rightly or wrongly, this is an assumption that students make. And so they're drawn in part towards topics adjacent to or within economics due to a sense that that's going to set them up for careers in finance and consulting, in the law or whatever else, all these fields that economics is seen as having a kind of organic relationship with. But in having that orientation, they haven't lost this sort of natural curiosity that humans tend to have about these other broader dimensions of human life that expand the analytical beyond the analytical framework that's typically used in economics departments alone. And so my guess is that these programs sort of seem legibly pre-professional to students, while at the same time allowing them to ask some of these bigger philosophical, you know, humanistic questions that they still go to college wanting to address.
I'll say one more thing about some of the student opportunities. This past summer, two of our MPE students, I keep saying ours as if I'm still there. I'm very attached to Hopkins and the Center for Economy and Society. Two of the Moral and Political Economy students interned at the World Bank and the International Food Policy Research Institute. It was a paid internship that we helped set up with those organizations. And they came back with just glowing reviews, both the organizations glowingly reviewing the students and their experience as well. So I think we expect a healthy portion of our students to be going into that kind of work as well.
Yeah, I was wondering, so, you know, Simon invoked Eleanor Ostrom, and, you know, one of the things that was very fascinating about both Eleanor and Vincent Ostrom is that they didn't only work with graduate students, they worked with undergraduate students and got them involved in their projects. As their title of their center was called a workshop, and they meant it as like, just like it would be like a workshop, you know, they made furniture. So it was built on that model in a strange way. But I was wondering if there's opportunities for undergraduates to work with you guys in your scholarly capacity. Because one of the things that I think when I, as an outsider, look at this, you know, I'm thinking, oh my God, like I could go and, you know, work with Angus Bergen on intellectual history. Like, you know, I wish I was 18 and I could go do that. Or if I could work with Glory Liu on these questions, you know, I'd want to go do that or whatever. And so, you know, are those kind of opportunities there for the students that are in the majors, or is that more like what's going on with the postdocs and things like that?
So I'll comment there briefly. So the short answer is yes, there are those opportunities. So again, the program only started last year, but one thing that we put within it is undergraduate research assistant opportunities. And so I worked with a student last year, or Gloria and I worked with one student. I worked separately with another student on two different projects. Gloria and I are also working with two of our students this year on this project on PPE and civic thought type programs. They're helping us gather data. They're reading some of the literature. They're getting engaged. Not only that, there's some other things that the center is in the process of setting up that the students are going to be getting involved in. So it's things that we don't quite have yet, but which we will have soon, because like Angus said, we've got our first graduating class of seniors now. So one project that we're going to be launching is one set of the programming for the Center for Economy and Society are these kinds of dinner series that some of the faculty have in DC. So Yuanyuan Ong, Henry Farrell, and Steve Tellis are involved in these different dinner series. So for example, Steve's one also involves his colleagues that he has at the Niskanen Institute. Now, we are next year planning to start a Baltimore dinner series. Now, a crucial aspect of that for us is going to be including students, so 2 to 4 students at these dinners, where they would meet people who are at the forefront of important contemporary political economic problems. So things like housing in Baltimore, or thinking about climate change, or like how we think about it at a local political level. So that's one thing that we're going to be doing. Another part of our programming is we often have these, or not often because we're still pretty new, but we are engaged in these convenings, and we're also going to be bringing some students along to these convenings. So, for example, there's a program on pluralism in housing that Glory and Steve have been involved in. And we want to try and bring a couple of our undergraduate students who plan to write their honors theses on these kinds of topics to these convenings to meet the people who are actually working on this in the real world, rather than just the academics. So if you have to meet developers, architects, finance people for housing, what would that look like and how should you think about it as an undergraduate student who wants to do research in these areas? Yeah, we're trying to think about this in a multidimensional way. There are internships that Glory mentioned, RA positions, but then also other kinds of involvement that the students might have with our research and programming.
This was something, obviously, most students who go through an undergraduate program go on to careers outside of academia. That's to be taken for granted. But we were very much mindful of those students who would go through this kind of program and then eventually go on to get a PhD in a field. One of the things I'm intensely aware as a historian who's done some work at the boundaries of economics, that one of the problems these disciplines have, and the disciplines themselves are very intensely aware of these problems, is that they don't have enough practitioners in the discipline who are able to read and engage with work in other proximate scholarly fields, right? And so certainly within history, I think a lot of historians would acknowledge that there just aren't enough historians who can read economics, and that creates big historical questions that we just can't answer due to our own incapacities. And it also creates disciplinary divides where having an economic historian in an economics department talk to somebody who's doing an adjacent topic in a history department, sometimes it's like you're talking across an unbridgeable chasm, right? And to solve that, you have to go deeper than just graduate training. Graduate training is necessarily specialized. People are trained to engage in a specific field. And so what you need to do is have a student who goes to get an economics PhD at a place like Harvard, having read already a lot of historical work, or vice versa. They go to a history program having done a lot of economics, and they have to have had a structured undergraduate curriculum that allowed them to do that and to begin thinking across these realms. And so those outlying students, but those outlying students who are going to go on to an academic trajectory, we thought was very important to the mission of what we're trying to achieve.
One way in which I think we really build in that methodological and intellectual political pluralism is in the course that Angus and I taught last year, Social Theories of the Economy. Right? Students are going to be reading Friedman's 1953 Methodology of Positive Economics, and they're also going to be reading Adam Smith's Theory of Moral Sentiments. Right? They're going to be reading texts from across disciplines, difficult texts, and across what you could call left-coded and right-coded spaces, right? So we think that students who are going to gravitate more towards, you know, Hayek and Friedman should be reading Hegel and Marx, and students who are going to be gravitating towards Hegel and Marx are going to read a lot of James Buchanan too. So however you want to kind of dice up that spectrum, and I would say additionally, we have a lot of thinkers on here that you really can't categorize easily. And that's one way of, I think, making a syllabus that can otherwise feel quite stale, right, like a march through the canon chronologically, make it seem way more interesting, like there's ongoing debates and conversations across historical contexts and also across disciplines that inform the way they think about the economy.
I wanted to ask Simon a question about experiments and getting undergraduates involved in experiments. The reason for this is that one of my most intellectually interesting experiences was working with Vernon Smith and Bart Wilson. They've invented a term called humanomics, okay? But what before they came up with that term, one of the things that Vernon and Bart did was, the reason why I was involved is they had Socratic seminars set up interrogating classic texts. So Smith's Theory of Moral Sentiments, Hume's treatise, you know, and all this stuff. And then from that, they would derive certain propositions, which they would then try to test in the lab, you know, by doing experiments, trust games or whatever kind of things like that. And it was fascinating because we would read the text, we would do the experiment, and then afterwards you would have an interrogation of the experience between the two of them. And it was a really fascinating exercise, I think, in trying to do that, because active learning often is a lot more sticks in their head more than just reading text kind of things. And I was wondering if you had experiments going on, because I know that that's in your background, and if you were involving the undergraduates in experiments or a lab that you have associated with the MPE program?
So we don't yet have a lab associated with the MPE program, although I would love to include students in future experimental work. So a few things to think about there. One is that I do get my students to participate in experiments. And so exactly in this class that I'm teaching right now, People, Power, and Pay, the Economics of the Workplace, we teach talk about a variety of things, but because one of the things we'll read is actually some papers that use public goods games and also try to think about different kinds of punishment in the workplace, they use, so Charlie Holt has this rather kind of super easy to use, but not the most attractive website called Beacon Lab, which I've used for years. And the students participated in public goods games and then also did the public goods games of punishment to see this aspect of, yes, we can engage in this public good and then our cooperation degenerates, but then this ability to punish each other results in greater cooperation. And having done it without having been taught the ideas behind this first, but then seeing how it applies to other things like team production and other aspects of the workplace, they immediately get insights that they wouldn't have gotten otherwise. So I love that kind of thing. Not only that, I was involved in some orientation activities with students. And so you can do a very similar thing just with a deck of cards. And so I had something like two groups of 40-something freshmen, right, or first-year students, and they each got four cards, two red cards and two black cards, each of the same number. And then they had to decide how many of the red cards that they had to put in a common pot at their table, right? And then this was a way where you could get $1 for each card that you kept, and then 50 cents for each card that everyone put into the common pot, right? In principle. Now, you could then do this, and then they talk about it, and they were just like lit alive on this activity, I think, compared to some other ones where they were maybe just lectured at rather than being engaged in an activity about economics and about cooperation. So I am a huge advocate for using experiments in teaching, and I think it's just a massive shortcut as long as you also then structure it and also get students to write about it afterwards. Now, in terms of getting undergrads involved in it, experimental economics has also just changed so much since COVID. So like right now, I'm running some experiments with colleagues in Germany and England, and we are running our experiments with a population of subjects in the UK, but who are doing the experiments online using a platform called Prolific, right? And so that's quite different to what I used to do when I had folks sitting in a computer lab participating in experiments in that capacity. And I think this is something that folks who do experimental economics now are really kind of debating and discussing and trying to work out, like, what is the best way that we do this? And also, how do we ensure that our students who went through apprenticeships of doing that kind of work in the lab, right? So I have advised thesis students, honors thesis students previously, where one student that I had when I was at Smith College before, she was really interested in experiments to do with luck and deception. And she came up with some experiments. We went through ethics clearance. She ran them at the lab at UMass Amherst, which wasn't far from where we were at Smith. And she learned just so much from doing that as an undergraduate student, right? And so I'm hoping that some of our honors thesis students plan to do that kind of stuff in the future. But I also anticipate that they might be doing it online these days using a platform like Prolific. But that's still good experimental economics.
I really appreciate the spirit that all of you, you know, have expressed here about pluralism. I'm a big fan of that. I used to be involved in some heterodox communities trying to promote pluralism in economics. I did give a talk at New School for Social Research many years ago. And one of the things that annoyed me about the pluralism is that they actually didn't allow neoclassical economics to be part of the pluralism, right? So, you know, they were going to get rid of neoclassical economics and have pluralism of everyone else other than neoclassical. And I was like, that doesn't really kind of work. But I have an agenda. I mean, I, you know, as a personal scientist, the book that I'm working on at the moment is called The Fate of Moral Science in the Age of Scientism. And the core characters of that book are Ken Boulding and Albert Hirschman and Amartya Sen. But the book is bookended by Smith to Mill and then Hayek and Buchanan kind of on these ideas here. But so I wanted to, I'm all for the whole thing, but I personally, I have an agenda. I want to fight a particular thing. I wanted to reach out and talk to you about some of the projects you're working on now that are part of your scientific agenda. Gloria already said that she's on the circuit. By the way, Glory, you know, it's the combination of the 250th anniversary of the Wealth of Nations and the 250th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. It almost seems like someone would have written a book called Adam Smith in America. You know, just, you know, they that book needs to be read, right? You know, and stuff. So, but I was wondering, like, you know, I have other like books, like Simon, you were telling me about the book that you're currently, you know, writing. Angus, do you have a book that you're working on at the moment or?
Yeah, Pete, thank you for asking. And, you know, one of the, when you ask about agendas, one of the interesting things about being at the center is that you do discover through, you know, lunch meetings and things like that, different colleagues' agendas, right? And so there's a difference between a center, which has its own sort of unified agenda, which is something that we've deliberately eschewed, and then the individual agendas of the people who make it up, which is part of what makes the conversations interesting, right? And so figuring, and it's an interesting and challenging alchemy to figure out, well, what's the right degree of sort of commonality, at least of a certain kind of sensibility or willingness to entertain certain kinds of conversations that makes it work, even when people have such wildly different political worldviews or methodological orientations. But as far as my own work's concerned, yeah, right now, actually, I'm just this afternoon, I have to send off a paper that I've been working on. It's, I guess, peripherally adjacent to economics in some ways. It's I'm writing about, I'm finishing a book right now on the history of everything that everybody thought the internet was going to mean for politics and society and how it all went awry. But the stuff I've just been writing over the last couple of weeks, and I'm going to return from this podcast to go send off shortly, is on, I've been going through the Newt Gingrich papers from the 70s and 80s, trying to put together his very peculiar brand of conservative futurism, right? So how do you kind of reconcile the social traditional politics with an embrace of the digital future as being the sort of engine, this revolutionary engine in American life in some ways? And then I've been contrasting that a little bit with Al Gore's third way approach to digital politics in the 90s, which I really think in a lot of ways, ideas about what the internet was going to mean for the economy was really central to why a lot of economic debates in the 90s look very different than they do today. But all of which is to just try to get at this question as to why, you know, it's so much of politics in the last 15 years, so much of political economy has been pessimistic, infused with this idea that the world has gone deeply awry, that it's the job of the scholarly community to grapple with that and to understand it and to explain to students why the future seems so much darker to them than it did to many of their professors when they were young. And to go back into this material from the 90s and to see how widespread this optimism about the future of political economy was across left and right, right? I mean, that's one of the interesting things about Gingrich and Gore, is these two paradigmatic figures of 90s politics both thought the world was getting better and getting better fast, and that should be central to right-wing and left-wing politics, trying to understand what was driving that and what happened to it once everybody's perceptions of what a digital transition would mean began to change.
Right before this, I had our weekly PPE seminar, and it was Brian Kogelman, and he now has a paper on populism, and he's trying to explain, you know, this whole thing about basically angrynomics, you know, which is, you know, why everyone is so angry, and, you know, and so it's quite fascinating. Now, he didn't have such a good answer to why they're angry, but he had an answer that proposed solutions to resolving their anger aren't going to work. So we leave the seminar still pretty pessimistic. But Gloria, I know that you're pressed for time. So if you have anything you want to add.
I actually have a little bit of leeway here, but I just wanted to say thanks for what you said about the importance of pluralism. And I couldn't speak more highly of the way in which CES has curated and created and supported a real amazing culture of intellectual pluralism. And like, we have a lot of really good banter in our lunches. And I think that there are deep political and personal disagreements, but the way in which we've able to scope certain questions and find different axes of difference rather than traditional divides, I think allows our tensions to be productive. I think Steve Tallis, if he were here, he would refer to the idea of productive agonism. right? And it's not just dialogue across difference and put like two heavyweights from the extreme left and the extreme right in a room and like let them have a cage match, right? Like that's actually counterproductive. And I think the way in which we see things at the Center for Economy and Society is to find a different way of orienting the problem so that the differences become productive. And that has been one of the most intellectually enriching experiences to be a part of. In terms of what I'm working on, I need a break from Adam Smith. So I did the book Adam Smith's America. I'm still doing stuff related to that. I finished two pieces on Smith this summer, plus a piece for the Wall Street Journal, all in the lead up to the 250th. So I'm pivoting, and I'm pivoting pretty dramatically. I have one project going on Asian American political thought before the invention of Asian America. So looking at Asian immigrant writers in America and the kind of politics they envisioned of exclusion and inclusion. You know, to the extent that there's some political economy in there, it's because a lot of Asian immigration was tied to the idea of Asian labor. You know, the anti-monopoly and the anti-Japanese and anti-Chinese movements were deeply entangled in the late 19th and early 20th century. But then the other project that I think follows on the work that I did on Smith, but also these broader questions about what is political economy, what is a social theory of the economy, is a project that I want to do on Charlotte Perkins Gilman, who was a late 19th century feminist writer, most known for her dystopian short story and also utopian fiction writing. The Yellow Wallpaper is something that I think most high schoolers have to read. It's like one of the most assigned texts in this country, I think. But I'm really interested in her work on women in the economy, or in her book 1898, Women in Economics, and trying to read her as not just a feminist economist, right? Like an economist who happened to be a woman, but as a really early social theorist of reproduction and the architecture of the family. And by that, I mean the social architecture of families and who does the work of production and reproduction, but also the physical built environment. So the way in which she sees the rearranging of the physical environment and how that can reshape society is something I'm really interested in.
I mean, when I looked at your, you know, website and look around, I mean, I'm familiar with many of the individuals and, you know, you just have a lot of really fascinating intellectuals. Like, you know, Aang, for example, is doing this book on adaptive political economy. You know, I don't know where she's at in terms of it. We had her here to give a talk. You know, she's this fascinating, you know, scholar. Her series at INET on China and her books on China are just great. And so, you know, it's just there's a lot of vibrancy in the intellectual space there and whatnot. Simon, do you want to talk a little bit more about the Understanding book that you're working on? Because you sent me the outline of the chapters, but it sounds quite fascinating the way you're trying to bring that in as a principles textbook. Is that correct?
Yes. Yeah, exactly right. So, So it's a new book, Understanding Our Economy. It's going to be part of the broader Core Economics family of books. And I'd say, like in the Core Econ books, they highlight the roles of institutions, inequality, the future of work, and power. These are also core aspects of what we do in Understanding Our Economy. Now, what we also want to think about, though, are kind of what we think of as both the microeconomic scale of the importance of the gains from cooperation. So when I think about contemporary debates that are happening right now, I find that many folks have lost touch with that just really crucial idea of gains from trade, gains from cooperation, and how we can both do better from engaging with each other if we take two actors or groups of people. Yes, there are going to be conflicts of interest, and yes, there will be exercise of power, but also there are countervailing institutions which can help us understand how to distribute rents. And so when I think about some of the ideas that I want students to think about in the 21st century, having studied economics, that importance of the idea of gains from cooperation, and then yes, conflicts of interest, and yes, the importance of institutions, and yes, power being crucial, those are a good part of our first couple chapters of the book. And then we say, okay, but look, we want to zoom out and also think about things like innovation, progress, and the kind of hockey sticks of history. And I say hockey sticks because it's not just the hockey stick of income, but also the hockey stick of climate change, right? So both of those things have happened, and we have excellent scientific evidence for both of them. And then we want to think about the incentives for innovation that also exist. And so I was so pleased with the recent Nobel Prize about that. I'm like, yes, we've got our kind of four chapters of this, the first four chapters. And I've recently been we're getting a whole bunch of them digitized in sequence. And the book is going to be available free of charge and open online for folks over the next few months as the chapters get released and put on the webpage. So I just highlight those things. In terms of resituating, kind of reorienting introductory economics. So Glory mentioned Samuelson earlier. And so one can go back to him. In Samuelson's original book, supply and demand, although important, were much, much later in his book.
Until page 100 and something.
Exactly, right? And also quite crucially, he said that supply and demand should not be applied to the workplace, or to the labor market. So like I tell my students in my course that, but when we think about supply and demand, I absolutely, as an economist, I think that they are crucial to our understanding of the economy. But I think sometimes we have oriented like the start of economics too much around supply and demand. And so I really think like returning economics to some of these kind of political economy questions and putting those at the core, you really lure students in and they think, oh, yes, this is something I care about and where I can see myself as an actor making these kinds of decisions. And so that's what we're trying to do with understanding our economy. And because it's going to be free and open, I'm not saying that everyone will adopt it or can adopt all of it, but if you like some of what we're doing, it's going to be there, it's going to be free, it's going to be online, and you can take little bits of it that you like and want to use. But I'd also gladly chat to anyone who's interested, and I can send them advanced chapters as we get them online. And that'll be happening over the next year.
I was just going to say, as a plug for Simon's textbook, I read a few sections of some of the textbooks and thought to myself, like, wow, I could have spared myself a lot of undergraduate trauma if this had been the way that I had learned economics.
I have a slightly personal question to ask you, Simon, because you're working with Sam Bowles, who's one of the most interesting people to do economics in the last half a century or whatever, him and Herb Quintus. And what they did, how has that experience been? He's a fascinating intellectual because he's also so open to ideas. He has this great paper with Sethi, that deals with Hayek and everything, and he's just a really amazing thinker. Yeah.
Yes. So Sam is an incredible mentor and co-author and collaborator. So for folks who don't know too much about him, so he's in his 80s now, but he worked on a commission for the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. He later on was involved in a kind of heterodox program that got started at UMass Amherst and was very much kind of part of the left. And then subsequent to that was asked by Nelson Mandela to help think about labor in South Africa subsequent to the end of apartheid. And so I think... So I'm from South Africa originally myself. When I was looking for folks who I wanted to work with when I was going to graduate school, so Sam wasn't actually accepting grad students himself at that point, but I went to, of all places, the University of Siena in Italy to do my PhD because he taught in some of the courses there and I wanted to learn from him, having written my master's thesis kind of related to one of his papers. Exactly what you said. So I have this great admiration for his wide-ranging set of interests, from evolutionary biology to, like, we have this lovely model, which we think is Hayekian, and like strongly Hayekian based on some work from Murkowski and Ostroy in our textbook. And we speak about people being kind of rent-seeking perfect competitors. And we prefer that language to a kind of more Arrow de Bro or kind of Walrasian style understanding of general equilibrium theory, right? And that could only come about if you are deeply sympathetic to the work of Coase, of Hayek, of Herbert Simon, right? And just the interrelated connections among these folks in terms of how we think about economics manifesting in the 21st century. And so, yes, he's very omnivorous. I've learned a lot from him. And yeah, I have deep admiration for him.
Yeah, I mean, he's one of these guys that you look up to because it seems like he has a toe in everything. Right. So Santa Fe gets going. He's got a toe in that. Evolutionary biology, he's got a toe in that. He's so it's a made theory of cooperation, like you just said, right? I mean, it's a core idea of his. And so there's so much to learn. It's a very, I might have to revise my book, include him and Gintis in there as well, and what they represented. So anyway.
I think another plug for Sam, just especially across the political spectrum, is earlier in his career, there were some questions about where he was going to go. And Milton Friedman, who heard that there might be some challenges for him because of some like a position that he was taking politically in Massachusetts at the time at Harvard, he's like, we should try and hire him. And so there was this question about, I wonder about these kind of sliding doors about what would have happened if Sam Bowles had gone to the University of Chicago, right? And so it's just that there's some remarkable stories there that someone like Sam also has in his arsenal.
That's awesome. I want to thank you all very much for coming on here. I want to wish you all great success with your initiatives at Hopkins and in general in the profession and with your own work and stuff. So thank you for spending some time with me today. Thanks.
Thank you so much, Pete.
Thanks so much for having us on. This was a lot of fun.
Thank you for listening to the Hayek Program podcast. To learn more about the research, scholars, and work of the Hayek Program, visit hayek.mercatus.org. For more information about graduate student fellowship opportunities for students at Mason as well as at universities across the globe, please visit students.mercatus.org. We hope you recommend students to our programs or consider applying yourself.